Stiles and Watkins, Sacktown Sports, 2 hours down, 2 hours to go as we are about to go heavy on the Kings talk. The Athletic has ranked the Kings 20th best shooting team. I don't know if you can still use the word best once you get to 20th, but they are ranked 20th as far as teams shooting via their algorithm, which Chris has laid out for us prior to the break. But basically, they're third as far as three-pointers taken per game. They are 29th in mid-ranges taken per game. And then you factor in the percentages, then you factor in the free throws. And it's not great for a team as we are going to break down. We're going to break down the flow slash Princeton offense a little bit later in the show here. Not great for a team running that type of offense, Chris. Not, yeah. That's what it seems to me.
Yeah, no, definitely you're going to need to, just in general in the NBA, it's you're going to need to make shots. It's a make or miss league. But, yeah, I mean, especially if you're running the Princeton offense, you're going to need to be able to hit open jumpers, because that's what the whole point of getting everybody in motion and moving around is for, is to get an open look. So, yeah, you better be able to knock them down.
And they have not necessarily been able to do that the same way. Again, for reference, with this same exercise last season, the Kings ended 11th shooting team, and they are 20th so far this season. Which, if we want to look at this optimistically, we were a bit pessimistic yesterday. If you want to look at it optimistically, you could say, hey, winning record, and they clearly aren't playing as well as they should be. But the question is, that's the assumption that they eventually will. And I don't know when that's going to happen, as we, I'm going to leave Kevin Herter alone today because we got on him enough yesterday, but eventually you are going to have to turn it on because it's just going to catch up with you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they, it's nice that they've been able to kind of get results and do it without playing their best basketball. I mean, it definitely says something about this team. I don't think, necessarily it shows that, you know, oh, they've made such big strides on the defensive end that, you know, it's allowed their shooting to fall off a little bit. But nonetheless, you take it. I think it's good to look different or try to win in different ways. And I'm looking at the expected win-loss rating for the Kings right now on Basketball Reference. There's like some weighted thing where it's like actually how results go for how this game was played, what your actual record should be. Funny enough, the Kings' expected win-loss record is 14 and 15. So you could argue that the Kings have definitely gotten the benefit of kind of having some games that traditionally wouldn't go your way based off of how you played going their way.
That is really interesting.
It's definitely something. It's definitely something. And I mean, it makes sense kind of when you think about, juxtapose it with last year. Yeah. It does feel like this season hasn't gone quite as well as last year. So it's a little weird that record-wise, it seems like all things are pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, they've got to start looking better here. And we've talked especially a lot recently about them starting to hit their shots and looking or becoming more consistent of a team by hitting their shots. But I don't know if it's going to change, because to me it feels like we have a large enough sample size where I think we see Keegan Murray's kind of rounding back into the guy that we thought he was. But Kevin Herter doesn't seem to be turning the clock back anytime soon to last year. Harrison Barnes has been up and down all year. He's been a lot better now, but I don't think that this is just the HB that we're going to get the rest of the year. So I still think that there's a lot of room to improve.
Yeah, and there is nobody, I guess, on that team right now that can just be that stopper for you outside. Because I don't think, honestly, Malik is an interesting one. I don't think I would call him the Band-Aid. I think Malik can add, but if it's not De'Aaron, I don't even know if I would put Sabonis in that category. Because it so much is based upon who he's going up against that night.
Yeah.
You have one stopper when things aren't going well that you can count on for sure. That's De'Aaron Fox.
Yep.
So if he doesn't have it going, or if he's out of the game or whatever the case is, there's nobody to stop that bleeding. And you ain't going to do it defensively. You're 22nd in defensive rating. So they have some problems. I wouldn't say they're leaking, but if you look at it as if they were a boat, you better fix the boat before you get out to the deep sea waters. And that's going to be basically after this soft stretch, and we're in the throes of late January, early February, you look at the Timberwolves at 22-7 and the Thunder at 20-9, you're now five games back. This is that time after Christmas where the separation is going to begin, and you don't want to get left behind.
No, no, especially not when, like we said, the Kings have been have a little bit of an easier stretch right now. Now is the time to kind of hop on and take advantage of that. And as teams are starting to separate a little bit, I mean, yeah, you say Timberwolves have seven losses. The Kings have now kind of climbed up to 12.
Yeah.
You got to start kind of getting those wins up to make sure you're not near the play-in, because that's kind of the territory the Kings are starting to climb into is, you know, they're fringe play-in. They're on the better side of it where you're not involved in the actual tournament. But, man, you don't want in the last week of the season where you have three games, you don't want to be in a situation where you're going tick for tack or you got to win two of three in order to stay out.
We don't want that smoke.
We don't want pressure. We want to be as secure. Last year, the Kings were actually super lucky that they were in that three seed where they were, you know, four or five games away from the two seed, but also 3 to 4 games above the four seed. So they didn't really have to worry about jockeying for a position at the end of the year. That's a scary position to be in, especially for a team that, I mean, you know, the Kings still do have some gaps in their experience, and a situation like that is definitely one where they've never been through that. They've never had to really have, like, true gotta-have-it games. We talk a lot about, you know, tonight's a must-win, or, you know, you can't have losses like tonight if you want to be a good team. They really have not been in a true no, like if you don't win these games, your season is over kind of situation.
Sure.
And, you know, that's just kind of not one of those things. That's one of those things where you don't really know how a team is going to respond until they're in it. So as much as you can avoid that by creating separation now, the better off you are for it.
Well, I think we had the conversation a couple weeks ago about a different term instead of must win.
Yeah.
Because, no, none of these games are must win. You're not going to fall out of the playoffs. But do you really want to be in the play-in?
Right.
Do you really want to try to go through all that? So, no, they're not technically you have to win, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to win these games, right? They're not must-win. But at the same time, it's going to put you in a bad position, though.
Yeah.
You're not going to be in a great position. And you're down here in the dumpster with the Pelicans at 7, the Rockets at 8, the Lakers at 9, the Suns at 10. And these are teams – here's the problem. These are teams that really haven't hit their stride.
Yeah.
We don't know if the Lakers got a run in them.
Or make a move.
We don't know if the Suns got a run in them. We don't know if the Warriors got a run in them. And then all of a sudden, they start creeping up.
And Memphis, too.
And Memphis. So you got to win the games you're supposed to win. There's nothing we can do about it. You already lost to the Blazers. We got to move on. But this is the stretch where you really have to show up and show out. And to me, you lose to the Blazers, all right, fine. That just means you cannot lose to the Hawks.
Yeah, you already had your learning lesson.
Yeah, you cannot lose to the Hawks. And now it's a little bit more important that you get this game against the Grizzlies, because every game matters. And you also kind of want to cool the Grizzlies off.
Yeah,
because you blink and they're back to 500. That's another team you got to worry about.
Yeah, no thanks. I'm good. I think the Western Conference is already deep enough, and you know, I know, you know, the Grizzlies always were going to be this team that was going to do this in the you know, last three quarters of the season. They were going to always start to play better when Ja came back, but yeah, the last thing you want to do is give that team momentum. And yeah, I mean, you got to take care of this stretch of games. I mean, yeah, we talked about this 9-game stretch where the Kings are playing opponents their combined records under 400. Mm-hmm. You just got to win that, man.
Yeah.
Like, especially with how hard this league is, you got to take care of the easy ones if you want to make your life easier.
Yeah, and this has been a confusing season for the Kings. Successful
Super
so far,
confusing.
But very confusing. But ultimately, if you can't get these done, we're not saying you're done, but it just makes the road so much more difficult. I know, what is it, late January, we can look at the schedule again. I know they go to the Sixers and they go to the Bucks. So definitely want to try to stack up some wins now. All right, got to get to a break. When we get back, we are breaking down the Flow/Princeton offense and what the Kings can do to improve, or do they just have to simply make shots? Styles and Watkins, Sacktown Sports. Stiles and Watkins, Sactown Sports. We take you up to 2 p.m. Simone doing a great job, as always, behind the glass as we break down some of the X's and O's, no pun intended, of the flow offense, as Coach Mike Brown calls it, also known as the Princeton offense, that the Kings run. So many times we get somebody on the Sac chat or somebody on the text line or a caller. If you want to be a part of the conversation, 916-339-1140, saying, Alan, Chris, they shoot so many threes. What's up with this offense? So we did some digging, and I'm going to read this. This is from the coachesclipboard.net. This is a high-level look at the Princeton offense as they've run it. Okay, so the Princeton offense right here. It is not an easy task to write about the Princeton offense. It has been said that this offense benefits a team whose players are less athletic than their opponents. But I disagree, as a Princeton offense requires all players to be good passers, ball handlers, and good outside shooters, as well as possess a high basketball IQ. Since players must have a good understanding of the game and know how to read the defense, this offense would not be ideal, obviously, for, they're saying, younger players as well, middle school or anything like that. This offense would benefit a team that lacks tall post players but has good, smart perimeter players. The Princeton offense is a more deliberate offense, oftentimes with many passes each possession. This tends to slow the game down, controlling the tempo, usually resulting in lower game scores. Coaches have to be completely committed to this offense, as it is a freelance offense with less control from the bench. Now, I asked Chris about that, about the tempo piece, and Chris, basically, you were saying, well, they just run it really fast.
Yeah, I mean, they come off screens. I mean, yeah, because traditionally the Princeton offense is a little bit of slow it down, like, you know, like, the you know, you got a big man up top, maybe if you have them run the high post version of it. And, you know, it's just a lot of motion, and with motion takes time. And so it's kind of a late developing offense. But the Kings kind of combat that by just sprinting through all the action. I mean, if you see Kevin Huerter or Keegan Murray come off a screen, they're going full tilt, which makes it, I mean, which sometimes I do think might be not so great for their shooting percentages. I think it's really tough to kind of go from a full-blown sprint to then coming on the other side of that screen, trying to stop, square your shoulders, and shoot. That's what makes these guys such elite shooters, but I think it does lead to a lot of Kevin Huerter shooting slumps, and maybe sometimes Keegan Murray as well. It's just tough to do. But yeah, that's kind of how the Kings combat it. It's just by running as fast as possible and trying to keep up the pace, because at the end of the day, the Kings are a team that is best when they push the tempo.
And you were saying that really the Kings have run this on and off throughout the years, but Jay Triano, being the offensive coordinator, if you will, is really the guy kind of manning this whole offensive situation.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Coach Kirill, who invented the Princeton offense, was famously a part of the Kings coaching staff in the early 2000s with Rick Adelman. So they ran a version of the Princeton offense as well during that time. And it's really, I mean, if you think of, especially now after the success of last year, Princeton offense is kind of like, you know, in the same way that the West Coast offense is associated with the Niners, like it's not associated with the Kings from a national perspective, but just from, if you were to say what is Kings basketball, I think it is a version of the Princeton offense where it is just motion, passing, big men passing as well, and having everybody just kind of pull on a string and have it really be a sense of true team basketball, not isolation, like was really popular in the early 2000s or mid 2000s, I guess. I think that the Kings just kind of when they've always been at their best, they have ran a version of Princeton basketball, and I think it's perfect for this team. I mean, you read out from the even just the technical definition or the explaining of the Princeton offense really is an explanation of the Kings offense.
It's
a big man who's a little bit undersized, but they have so much. Just, I mean, and that's when
less athletic.
I mean, yeah. Whitey is always talking about how, and I heard Phantom talk about yesterday how, you know, the Kings' athleticism, just in terms of their forwards, is a real weak spot for this team. I think it's the perfect offense to run, and I think you see, I mean, it's kind of hard to debate that when the Kings have the greatest offense possibly of all time last year running it. And I think this year it's just it's really hard. I think that's the toughest thing, when the reason why we're kind of bringing this up is do you need to maybe make some adjustments? Because I talked about yesterday, I do kind of think the up-tempo offense they run does lead to the reason why, or a part of a reason why, they're unable to seemingly play defense consistently for, you know, a 30-game stretch. I think it's really, really exhausting to keep up that pace and to run and just move in general as much as they do, and at the same time be expected to kind of play top 15, top 10 defense in the NBA. I just think it's a really tough task. I don't think it's impossible. I think Mike Brown is asking a whole lot of his guys. It's just, you know, it's a process. It's just tough to be that conditioned of an athlete in general, and then to also be an elite player while being one of the most elite conditioned guys. I mean, that's what everyone always marvels about Steph Curry for, is the fact that he's able to run miles and just still be an incredibly efficient shooter. It's impossible to guard.
He also hasn't been a great defender.
Right. And that either ties into, right.
But they've been able to kind of cover that up. And Steph has gotten better throughout the years. You know, I wonder if we can find some type of percentage, because obviously you look at De'Aaron, the fourth quarter stuff at the end of games. There are clearly times when De'Aaron takes over, yeah, and they don't really run the offense, right? I know Sabonis typically does, but even I would even say in Portland, when he saw the food guarding him, he just decided, I'm just going to eat. So I wonder how often the Kings run it, or yeah, say, hey, well, could you even argue the screen and roll with Malik? Is that part of it, or is that a wrinkle in it?
I mean, Mike always talks about how there's counters in their offense. I would say it's a count. I mean, that's also, it seems like they run, they will call a pick and roll for JaVale and Malik, but mm-hmm, also there are built-in pick and rolls into the counters of that offense. I mean, if Sabonis denies the first initial handoff, they just kind of run it to the next guy, and mm-hmm, you can run a pick and roll off of that instead. There's so many different layers to the Kings offense. And that's why Mike always just says, like, it's a free flowing motion offense. There's not really a ton of plays called. There are, like I said, some pick and rolls called and maybe some different sets called for, but for the most part, it's all on the players to understand the fundamentals of the offense and then kind of add your own little funk and flair where you see fit. I mean, last year Mike talked about how, you know, Kevin and Sabonis were getting chemistry with, you know, Kevin maybe faking coming around the handoff but actually cutting on the back end and just kind of getting creative with that, and mm-hmm, and Kevin and Malik, you know, doing ring around the rosy, essentially figuring, you know, trying to confuse their defender on who's cutting, who's going to come around the screen. There's a lot of different variations that you can have off of it, but it's just a really good fundamental foundation to have for your offense, is really how I would explain it.
Yeah, and I am curious, you talk about some of the back cuts and things like that. I know he was the defensive guy when he was in Golden State, but it is a little bit surprising to me that when you talk about the wrinkles, and maybe, look, maybe this thing is evolving, it is a little surprising that, hey, our shots aren't falling. We have, you know, call it whatever you want, a Golden State wrinkle in this offense, to where we're back cutting.
Right.
And we're getting some easy looks for Kevin Huerter. We're getting some easy looks for Keegan Murray, because they are such good shooters. I think some guys do need to overplay. So I am a bit surprised that that hasn't really been implemented yet on the side of Coach Mike Brown, to just add some different looks. Or maybe they feel like they're treating this thing like a living, breathing thing, and it's just going to continue to grow. But there are some nights where it does feel a little bit one-trick pony-esque, and I think that's the issue.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm looking right here at just in terms of to try and get a grasp of how much movement is in the Kings offense. They're actually third in the NBA when I'm looking at NBA motion, the tracking stats. They're third in the NBA in miles traveled per game. just by play. 19 miles per game.
So once we get back, we got to get to a break. Yeah. Simone's giving me the Damian Lillard and or the Tyrese Halliburton. When we get back, I want to compare those numbers to the team's defensive ratings and see if there's a correlation between teams that run a lot and the ability to play defense. Okay. Well, we'll get that. We got Chris out here doing VLOOKUPs. He's got his Google Sheets out. He's doing it all for us. Stiles and Watkins, Sactown Sports. Stiles and Watkins, Sactown Sports, taking up to 2 p.m. This is of 10 minutes ago. Some media availability. This is from Rob Statsguerra. Brock Purdy, quote unquote, said he got a lot of treatment on his shoulder. A lot of treatment for that stinger. So we will keep an eye on that as we get ready for Niners Commanders and continue to talk Kings. So we did. Chris pulled out the VLOOKUP, and there are some really interesting notes to take from this because there seems to be a line as to you can pull this off if you got the horses and the personnel. But if you don't, you're not going to be good defensively. Chris, take it away.
Yeah, really strange. So, like we said going into the break, there is definitely a correlation between miles, you know, distance ran in terms of miles and being a bad defense. Mm-hmm. They even have it broken down on NBA.com.
Let's hear it.
Offense and defense. Uh-huh. You can see, you know, if you ran a ton of defensive miles but not a ton of offensive miles, all that stuff. Again, the Kings are third in offensive distance ran this season. Spurs are number one in terms of distance ran. They are sitting right now at 25th in defensive rating.
That's not good.
The Indiana Pacers famously are now running the very similar offense to that the Kings ran last year. They are second in terms of distance ran. They are 28th in terms of defensive rating. Kings, again, third in distance on offense, 21st in defensive rating. Charlotte Hornets are fourth in terms of offensive distance ran. They are 29th in defensive rating. Utah Jazz are fifth in terms of offensive distance traveled. They are 24th in defensive rating. So all of the top five teams in terms of miles ran on offense, averaged per game, are also bottom 10 defenses in the NBA. That to me is there's a clear line of connection there. I mean, it's a tough task. And granted, all of those teams are younger teams, so maybe that also plays a factor into it. But to me, just in general, it's common sense. Like if you're going to run a lot on one end, you're probably going to be a little tired on the other end, and you're probably naturally going to save a little bit of energy on the defensive end because you understand that offense is where your bread is buttered. So it's kind of a back and forth, but you did mention there is a line to this, and it's a pretty hard line as well. Like I said, the top five teams in terms of offensive miles ran is also bottom 10. Number six is the Golden State Warriors. They're 15th. Dead average in terms of defensive rating. Oklahoma City follows them at number seven. Oklahoma City is sixth in defensive rating. Orlando Magic is eighth in terms of distance traveled. They are fifth in terms of defensive rating. 76ers follow them in terms of distance traveled. They are second in terms of defensive rating. So you have the first five being bona fide bottom 10 defenses. However, the next four are all top 15 offenses. Mm. And then after that, it's the Wizards who are dead last in the NBA in terms of offensive rating. So you have six teams that are you have six of the 10 distance traveled offenses are bad, terrible, bottom 10 defenses. And then you have four of those teams that somehow managed to be top 15, with three of those being top six.
So it seems like there is a line there. And if the Kings...
That distance traveled, by the way, is anywhere from pretty much over 10 miles ran per game as a team.
Right, and here's the thing. If this thing starts out with how much they're running, and they are 20th right now shooting-wise, right?
Mm-hmm. Based on the
athletics algorithm.
I didn't even cross-reference
that. If you are bottom 10 in defensive rating and your shooting has struggled, it seems to me like you're rushing.
Yeah.
right? Sure. And you're what are they, number three in miles spent right. on offense. It feels like you're rushing. And you said they were second in speed, right?
Speed. Yes, they have average speed here, and average speed, the Kings are tied for second at 4.42. I don't know exactly what that's measured.
It sounds frantic.
And that might be miles per hour. I have no idea. I have no idea what that
All we know is they're two, and it sounds frantic, and it sounds rushed.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they even think about slowing it down a little bit, and we've talked about the lack of athleticism, and that's why they run the – one of the reasons they won the Princeton offense. Yeah. But something has got to give here, and I don't know if it's sustainable because throughout the course of the season, the more tired you get, the more miles that are on you. It's hard for me to believe – we're going to get to a point where I'm going to stop believing that the defensive rating is going to climb, right?
Yeah.
It might stay the same, but I don't see – if we end January and the Kings are – what are they right now? You said they're 21st. If we end January and the Kings are still 21st in defensive rating.
I think they just are.
I think that you're capping that at best at 17, 8, maybe 16 if you get lucky. That's just who they are. So they have to make some decisions quickly here, whether it be people on the roster and rotations or those not on the roster and trade candidates. So, yeah, that was definitely eye-opening because it feels like it, but you don't ever really get the numbers
to
back it up. They just need to slow it down like New Edition. That's
To even throw a stranger wrinkle into all of that, again, the top pace team or the teams that run the most also, when you look at pace, which is the stat that they use for possessions per 100 possessions or something like that. I can't remember what exactly it is. But the Kings are 10th right now in terms of pace. And those teams, the other teams that are up there in terms of miles ran, are all top three. You have the Wizards at number one. You have Pacers at number two in terms of pace. You have the San Antonio Spurs at three. Those are all names that were on the most distance traveled. So the fact that the Kings are 10th in that category tells me that they're running a lot, but it might not always be leading to, like you're saying, though, it might not always be leading to rushed action. It is a little bit of they're running the sets, but it's not always equaling good-looking opportunities for whatever reason. And I don't know what that's about, but I do think that the Kings would benefit from maybe – just overall slowing the pace down like you're getting at. Like I think last year they were incredibly efficient from all three layers of the floor. They were great at attacking the rim, top 10 in terms of efficiency at the rim, top 10 in terms of efficiency in the mid-range, and then top 10 in terms of efficiency from the three-point line. So to me, they have the ability to knock down shots if they can get it open, but for whatever reason, this season they just – I would say that maybe I would like to look at some shot quality numbers. It to me feels like, though we did look at their open shot percentages early in the year, it just feels like for whatever reason the shots aren't going down. And I mean, the first place I would look would be, I just think in general, let's take a breath and let's slow down. Let's make sure we're set before we're taking everything.
It sounded like my coaches and my dad when I was in CYO.
Right. Yes. When you're like in eighth grade or something.
You're a little frantic
like,
right
just
now.
Relax,
man.
Just relax.
I'm like, breathe. No, I gotta go.
Yeah.
I get this lefty layup off. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if what we're talking about is possible, right? When you talk to Coach Mike Brown in the, whether it's a pregame or postgame presser, he talks so much about pace.
Yeah.
I think it's indoctrinated in what they do. No, I don't see them, especially if we're talking about a team who's 16-12 and fifth in the West, right? We're not talking about a dumpster fire team here. So I don't know what they do. The question is, you're a fifth seed, but could you be a fourth, third, second seed if you did do these things? And that is going to be the question. Honestly, and this was a fun exercise and I learned a lot, I just don't see them making any drastic changes this season.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be tough. It'd be really tough to just kind of throw everything that you worked on during training camp and all that stuff. The only way I can really see anything significant changing is if they make a big move for a guy who's actually going to be a major part of the rotation, just because at that point you almost have to. I mean, you got to teach that guy new stuff anyway. You might as well use that as an opportunity to maybe switch things up. But I think for the most part, I mean, it's working for the most part. It's just, again, this team has some pretty obvious flaws that when they get exposed, there's just not much they can do about it. So I feels like maybe next year or going into next offseason, you can make a big shift. But to me, unless they're going to make a big personnel shift, I think it'd be tough to just kind of go away from what's gotten you here so far.
Not this soon. Yeah. Not this soon. All right.
And it fits. I mean, it works. Right. It works some of the time.
Well, like we said, this is a team who is, they can get hot and then we'd sound crazy, yeah. Right? We won't know. We can rehave this conversation at the end of the season based on what happens. Got to get to a break. When we get back, a very interesting post from our own Brendan Nunes, who asked the question, which non-star trade candidate would you want on the Kings? Let's get into it when we get back. Styles and Watkins, Sacktown Sports. Styles and Watkins, Sacktown Sports, taking you up to 2 p.m. Reacting to a post from our own Brendan Nunes, Sacktown Sports Kings Insiders, who asked the question, what non-star trade candidates intrigue you for the Sacramento Kings? Obviously, you can go other here, but he has named a few names I have currently. For example, Matisse Thybulle, Malcolm Brogdon, Alex Caruso, Torrey Craig, PJ Washington, Royce O'Neal, Dorian Finney-Smith.
Can I just say yes? I just want them all. I'll take any of them.
Any of them?
I will take absolutely any of those guys.
Malcolm Brogdon is interesting. He's up in
He's definitely
Portland.
The best of all those guys, for sure.
He's the best. The question is, do you need him?
No. I don't know. That's kind of a tough one because he's a dude who's always kind of been like that. He's okay coming off the bench. I think, you know, ideally he would be the backup point guard in this situation, kind of like what I assume the Celtics thought he would have been for them last year.
Right.
I think they could. I do think that would be a really steadying presence at the point guard position where you can just put the ball in his hands and feel good about it and takes the ball out of Malik's hands, which – has its pluses and its minuses for sure. I wouldn't mind that. I don't know what Portland would want. I mean, funny enough, there's two guys on the list from Portland. Maybe, like, what would a Matisse Thybulle and Malcolm Brogdon, what would they want back from that? I don't know, because trading with Portland is just, it's a tough situation because what is their need? Like, they probably want
they
young guys.
They don't know.
They don't want, unless they, I mean, yeah, because they have Jerami Grant too, so maybe there is a world where they're like, where they think it might not be so bad to be slightly competitive, you know, maybe competing for those play-in spots. Because, I mean, we saw the other day, there's some talent there. Anthony Simon, Scoot Henderson,
Shaden Sharp back.
Got Shaden Sharp back.
Herter and Harrison on that team.
Like, it's not far away from being a semblance of a roster there that could do some damage. So, yeah, I mean, it kind of comes up to what Portland wants. But I would love Malcolm Brogdon. He would be by far the best answer at backup point guard if he's willing to take it.
And we have to look at the contract situations. Yeah, there's no way. Matisse Thybulle, I know he hit a couple threes against the Kings, but who didn't when they played a couple nights ago? That guy averaging, and we talked about this with Vanderbilt. We'll talk. These are conversations that Chris and I have off air. We tend to go back and forth with the line of the defensive stopper and what they can provide offensively. And I'm probably putting Matisse Thybulle and Vanderbilt in similar categories, but I think Matisse is probably better offensively.
I think so, yeah. Barely. Matisse is starting to hit his threes. I think he's at 39 or 40% nowadays from three on like two or three attempts. So I think that he's somebody who's at least figured out how to be on the floor.
39.6.
There you go. If he's able to knock it down at that rate, I think the Kings can find 15 minutes for him for sure. The Vanderbilt thing is interesting because he's averaging like 1 point a game. No joke. Like, not,
that's
like,
what I said.
Somehow
you.
Not a joke. He's actually averaging a single point per game. But he does provide so much length and athleticism and kind of almost exactly what the Kings need defensively. But it is a question, and I've talked about it before. The Kings tried to throw out Mo Harkless into a starting lineup. They tried to throw KZ Akpala into the starting lineup last year. You got to, and you know, they've also tried to put Davion. You can put Davion in that conversation as well. You have to provide some form of base layer of offense just to justify you being out there, because while yes, the Kings do need defensive help, their offense is where their bread is buttered. And if you're just a complete liability on the offensive end, if you just stall the offense while you're out there, that's a lot more detrimental than your defense being beneficial, unless you're just like Scottie freaking Pippen or something.
Right. And nowadays with everybody shooting or teams being so three heavy, it feels like, now I'm going old school here, it feels like it sticks out more when you don't have a shooter,
because
all you're doing is shooting.
Yeah.
So the it's not that they're more disrespectful than they were back in the day. It's that so many people were getting to the paint.
Yeah.
You didn't have to, you were leaving people in a different way.
Totally.
You weren't just leaving them on an island the same way. So, yeah, I think if you say Matisse and Brogdon, I don't know how Brogdon affects, the Malik situation, if we take a look at Brogdon's contract, but there's no way I'm doing Thybulle by himself.
I would think about, I mean, oh, if you're the Kings, you're saying?
Depending on what they want, I mean, I'd have to.
I wouldn't mind Matisse Thybulle. I think he would fit into the rotation pretty nicely. And
who are you giving up for him, though?
Yeah, I don't know. Again, yeah, I don't know what his value sits at anymore, because when he was in Philly, it felt like every team that was in a winning situation was like, we got to get Matisse Thybulle over here.
He was the hot name.
And now that he's in Portland, it just kind of feels like everyone's like, ah, he doesn't exist anymore. And he's just not the same hot commodity that he was before. So with that said, I mean, it seems like the perceived value would be at best a late first round pick. If not, you could probably figure out some sort of player swap, player exchange that I think would make some sense. But I don't think Matisse Thybulle would really ask for that much. My number one with a bullet is absolutely Alex Caruso. For me, I think that's a dude who's just a winner. And he can play either the backup point guard or he can play the backup two. I honestly think he could steal a lot of minutes in terms of closing lineups. Like, he's the type of dude who you just want to have him on the floor when the game's being decided, because he's going to do something to win the game. He can knock down threes at a good enough level. He's one of the best perimeter defenders in the NBA. He's also just like a hustle guy, which the Kings don't really have. Davion's a dog when it comes to on-ball defense, but you don't really see him. You see him dive on the floor a couple times, but Alex Caruso is one of those just lunatic maniacs who takes it to another level and is like diving into the crowd and just doing whatever it takes.
Yeah.
He's like the definition of what you would say is just a winning basketball player.
I would put JTA in that category, but I would put Alex Caruso higher up offensively. JTA doesn't do enough offensively to play him the minutes, and he's not as good defensively as Alex Caruso. So I think you have that on the Kings, but JTA just doesn't do enough other stuff.
He's not going to get minutes either.
Right. Yeah. He does not do enough other stuff. 916-339-1140 if you want to be a part of the conversation. Like Sean, who wants to talk some Kings. What's up, Sean? You're on Sals and Watkins, Sacktown Sports.
What's up, guys? Hey, something I want to bring up. I think the most overrated common suggestion is you need to have defensive players on the floor. Because this is what I think. I think the more scoring you have, the better your chances are winning. And when the time comes to play defense, the Kings played defense last year, right? Game four, game five was kind of a letdown, but game six was a great defensive game. Even in game seven, if it wasn't for Steph, they had a good defensive game. So I think instead of seeing who can play defense, because you could unless if they're a Ron Artest type of defender, right, which there aren't many of them out there, I think you have to add to your strength, right? Get more scoring in there. I mean, we're basically getting 15 points a night out of the 2 and 3, right? So we need to add scoring. And then when the time comes to play defense, I think these guys will play defense because they played it last year when the time came to play defense. And one last thing before I go. I think it was a big mistake by Monty. He hasn't made many, but last year in Game 7, which is our biggest game of the season, Mike Brown didn't play Davion Mitchell, right? Mm-hmm. So there was some sign that Mike Brown does not trust Davion Mitchell. The time to move on from Davion Mitchell was last year, this offseason. Now that he's back, I don't know if he has any trade value left, but we have no backup point guard. Keon Ellis is giving us some minutes, but we need something more consistent, and that's where they have to kind of get another player to fit into a rotation.
No, thanks for the call, Sean. Good stuff. Yeah, I mean, going more offense, that's essentially what the Kings did in the offseason by bringing in a Sasha Vezenkov and bringing in guys that they think, hey, we're just going to continue to try to score. Now, the issue is, to what Sean talks about, you're not getting that production from, I think he said 2 and 3, but I think just between Harrison Barnes and Herter. That's the issue here. They're barely getting to 15 combined.
Yeah.
So you got to fix that. I will push back on not needing a defensive player.
I completely disagree.
Well, you can't, you cannot. It's interesting, though, because you could say, well, you can get better offensively and then the defense doesn't matter as much. That's why we're having conversations about a Brogdon and Thybulle trade, because that you need both.
Yeah, I mean, you need both, but at some point, like, you have enough offense, and getting a stop is just as valuable as getting a bucket. And you can, I mean, everybody's in the NBA. Everyone can make points. Like, we just saw what our boy Duop, whatever, score 25 points.
Yeah.
Like, anybody on a given night can hit shots, but if you can slow a team down, that's the best way of being consistent every night. I mean, shots, you can be Keegan Murray, you can be Kevin Herter, who we all know are good shooters, but for whatever reason you can't hit a shot on a given night, your defense can be there to save you, and that's why it's so important to play defense, because in a playoffs where it's 2 months and you're playing potentially an extra, 30 games or whatever, you're telling me you're going to be able to hit shots for, you need to win four, you need to win 12 games or whatever, 16 games to win a championship. You're going to shoot well for 16 games? That's really tough to do. Maybe if you can play defense for 4 or 5 of those games, it just lightens the load. This team has to be better on the defensive end if they want to win championships. They cannot just get into shootouts and say, we have better shooters than you, because that might be true most of the time or some of the time, but it's not going to be true all of the time.
They need somebody that can defend the wings, and they need somebody that can create their shot. And one more piece for Sean, I would say that, number one, the Kings lost to the Warriors, so even though, they turned it up and, okay, at the end there was Steph Curry, well, Steph didn't score 100 or whatever points. He scored a lot, but he didn't score every – he went 50-piece, but he didn't score every point. So that's number one. Number two, if you had somebody, maybe you wouldn't have been in that situation. Yes. And number three, the Warriors basically got smacked by the Lakers, who got smacked by the Nuggets. So – I don't think the Warriors were very good last season, is what I'm saying. So if you weren't able to,
and the Kings
stop,
couldn't hit knockdown shots,
then they couldn't knock down shots, and you got to that game seven if you had that defender. And I to that point, Davion didn't play, but maybe if you had one more defensive piece, you're able to get through. So I wouldn't use last season's playoff. I can't even call it a run because you lost in the first series. Yeah. I wouldn't use that to use it as a example of the Kings turning it up. All right, gotta get to a break. When we get back, De'Aaron Fox hits a career high 7 threes in that loss. What can he do to truly be a part of the MVP conversation?